Okay, hopefully this records. So we left off last week. We had started talking about affectionate love in the husband-wife relationship. And I just want to review for a minute because there's a couple of things that I want to say and clarify and make sure people understand what I am saying and what I'm not saying. So we looked at the idea of affectionate love being finding delight in the other person. And so we talked about things that are outside necessarily. We talked about these loves bleed into each other, right? They may involve caring love, they may not. But we talked about how when we were dating our spouse, how we took care of ourselves, the way we looked, the things that we did, how we talked to one another, the actions we took, we obviously found delight in that person. People typically don't get married just because they think we'll be good friends. People get married, hopefully, for love. And the love we're talking about is romantic love. Okay. So we talked about that idea when we looked at Jacob and Rachel, and in by contrast with Leah, how Leah desperately craved that type of affection from her husband, and she didn't get it. And we saw the distress even in how she named her children, and how she thought that children would be a way to be able to finally obtain that type of feeling from her husband. But it didn't happen. And we made some analogies and some lessons from that. And we asked, if you were to ask each of your spouses, do you feel loved? And if they're being completely honest about whether or not they're receiving that type of love from you, what would their answer be? And that's a hard question because, as I have mentioned previously, my ways of showing affection are not always the way that Jennifer receives that affection. So while I may think in some ways I'm a very affectionate person, in other ways she would perceive me as not. And we'll talk a little bit more about that today. But what I do want to say is when I made the comment about women, are you taking care of yourselves? And men, I would say the same thing. Are you getting fat? Are you not taking care of yourself? I'm not referring to, and that may sound a little bit shallow, right? I mean, we should love our spouses regardless. But what I'm not saying is time takes its toll, right? I don't look like I did at 19. And there's nothing I can do about that. Certain things I can't control, and women the same way. So what I'm not saying is that we should be out trying to get plastic surgery and do whatever we can to look like we did at that age. That's not what I'm saying. What I am saying is, are we taking care of ourselves and attending to ourselves as we did when we were dating? Are we doing the things that we did when we dated or when we were first married? And whatever that may have been in your relationship. Jennifer likes flowers. I think some men wonder, what's the big deal with flowers? But to them, it's a sign of affection. So that's what I'm referring to. So please don't take it as, well, we all have to try to look like we did when we got married. No, that's not what I'm saying. I don't want to place that type of pressure or have that type of misunderstanding with the group. We did talk about how you can have affectionate love without caring love, and that can be dangerous. We looked at Samson and Delilah. We looked at Shechem and Dinah, and how affectionate love with the absence of caring love can be very selfish. We did look at Samson and Delilah as well, and we talked about the idea of how Delilah, it never says Delilah loves Samson. Never says that. But then how does that apply to us? Well, we saw that Delilah manipulated Samson. And I think probably all of us in this room, whether it's personal or someone we know, has seen someone manipulate another person because that person was infatuated romantically with them. And maybe you've been in a situation where you did things or thought things that you wouldn't have done, but you did because of how you felt about another person. And so maybe you compromised your morals or whatever it may have been. And hopefully none of us in this room have been that person where we've pressured someone into doing things because we knew. I mean, I can probably list just off the top of my head five relationships that I can think of where one party in the relationship knew the other person was crazy about them and they could manipulate them to do things that they normally would not do. All right, that pretty much brings us back up to where we left off last Sunday. So affectionate love may be unlawful and morally ruinous. Now, we're going to talk about Solomon a couple of different times, but right now we're going to talk about Solomon from 1 Kings chapter 11. If you look over at 1 Kings chapter 11, was Solomon a wise man? We would also, when we think of wisdom, right? If we're talking human terms, I believe all of us would, Solomon would roll off the tip of our tongue pretty quickly. Okay, let's read verses 1 and 2. But King Solomon loved many foreign women as well as the daughter of Pharaoh, women of the Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Sidonians, and Hittites, from the nations of whom the Lord had said to the children of Israel, you shall not intermarry with them, nor they with you. Surely they will turn away your hearts after their gods. Solomon clung to these in love, and he had 700 wives, princesses, and 300 concubines, and his wives turned away his heart. I've always struggled with this, just because you know Solomon knew better. You know he did. You don't be ascribed as one of the wisest men to ever live and make such a huge blunder without knowing it. And yet what I think this is a very strong argument for the power of romantic love. You saw it with Samson, but now here's one of the wisest men that ever lived. And he knows what God wants him to do. He knows it. In his head, you can have wisdom, but if you don't apply it, it's worthless. And that's what happened to Solomon. And that's what happened at the end of his life. He knew. I have to believe he knew what he was doing was wrong. Following these women into idolatry, that's against the core of who Solomon was that we knew him to be. And yet that's what he did. That's how powerful this love can be. I mean, it can be good or bad. I remember when I was dating Jennifer, and each of you think of your own relationships, there is nothing more each minute every day than I wanted to see her and be with her. That's what I woke up, that's what I thought about, that's what I thought about before I went to bed. Solomon, 700 women. Now let's just talk about the logistics of that for a minute. Guys, I can barely handle one wife. I don't know how you feel, but 700? 700 wives? It's a whole different conversation that can happen there about what kind of relationships he could possibly have with 700 women. But yet this love, this feeling was so strong that it led him into a path of sin that we don't have any indication that he ever recovered from. And I think probably we could think of people that we knew that were in the body and they married someone and they went down a different path. That's why it's so important. So important when you're looking to choose a mate. And again, I'm not speaking of just the drawing the line of have they been baptized, okay? That's not what I'm saying. Because I think we all know people that were in the body that may not have had the best heart. What I'm talking about is what kind of heart does your potential spouse have? Have you had the discussion of how are you going to help me get to heaven? Because if that's not important to that person and they don't have a sincere heart, I would strongly caution you to reconsider dating that person. Sean.
I can't help but wonder, too, because David, the Bible is multiple wives. And I mean, I know it's weird to talk about that, but I don't think he should have had multiple wives. And I can't help but wonder if Solomon learned some of this behavior from his dad. I wonder if his dads, too, as we have children, they're watching us and they're seeing what kind of love is important to us. It's just a thought.
No, I think it's a good thought, because for all of the good things we can say about David, do we have any evidence that David was a great father? He was a man after God's own heart, but this area he struggled with. He struggled with being a father. And you're right. Our kids, whether we think so or not, are much more in tune with our relationships than you may realize. And I'm seeing that now as I have a 23 and a 21-year-old. And I see who they're dating and how they interact. And don't ever tell them I said this, but they look at their mother, and there are some things about their girlfriends that are similar. They're not here, right? Okay, good. Anyway, so yes, that's a good point. What did Solomon learn from David? Turn over to Ezra chapter 10. You remember the people had returned from captivity, and what did they do when they moved back into the land as far as marriage? They too took pagan wives. And if you look at the beginning of chapter 10, it says, "Now while Ezra was praying and while he was confessing, weeping and bowing down before the house of God, a very large assembly of men, women, and children gathered to him from Israel, for the people wept bitterly. And Shechaniah, the son of Jehiel, said, one of the sons of Elam spoke up and said to Ezra, 'We have trespassed against our God and have taken pagan wives from the peoples of the land. Yet now there is hope in Israel in spite of this. Now, therefore, let us make a covenant with our God to put away all these wives and those who have been born to them, according to the advice of my master and of those who tremble at the commandment of our God, and let it be done according to the law.'" I can't think of any other situation in secular or biblical history that replicates this type of situation. I mean, this had to be tough. Now, why were the people crying? Now, you could make an argument that they were crying because they had transgressed against God, but it makes no distinction between men, women, and children in this passage. Would the women and children be weeping because they transgressed against the God they didn't believe in? I think that's a non-starter. Many of these relationships, I have to believe, they were strong, familial marriage relationships. Could you imagine having to separate from your spouse and your kids because that's what God wanted? I really have a hard time just getting my brain wrapped around that. That's difficult. They loved their families. They loved their wives. They loved their kids. And yet here it is, God telling them, you have to put them away. Again, we could make the same points we just made about Solomon and choosing who you choose for a mate. So when they had to make this very, very difficult decision, and I believe this application can be brought to our lives, what did they prioritize? What made their decision for them? That is what I'm looking for. If you look in verse 3, let us make a covenant with our God. They tremble at the commandment of our God. If you look in verse 8, actually look at verse 9. So all the men of Judah and Benjamin gathered at Jerusalem within 3 days. It was the ninth month, on the 20th of the month, and all the people sat in the open square of the house of God, trembling because of this matter. And then in verse 14, please let the leaders of our entire assembly stand, and let those in our cities who have taken pagan wives come at appointed times together with the elders and judges of their cities until the fierce wrath of our God is turned away from us in this matter. So, not only a fear of God in the sense personal relationship fear of God, but how did God deal with Israel back then as far as when they were disobedient? There was national discipline. I mean, you can look at Judges and see the cycle. Right? So fear of God and fear of what would happen to Israel as a nation made this decision for them. I know I'm beating a dead horse, but this type of love is so powerful that once you're caught up in it, it is extremely difficult to get away from it. I've seen it. I've seen it. People, their minds know better, but their heart keeps making bad choices. Okay, we're going to talk about something a little more positive. Song of Solomon. Raise your hand if you completely understand the Song of Solomon. Thank you. Good, then we're both coming into this with the same approach. As I prepared for this lesson, I will tell you, I've read the Song of Solomon. I've done some study over the years on it, but I've never really dived into it. Wow. When I was preparing for this class and trying to get a better overall grasp of the Song of Solomon, I mean, just based on what I found on the internet, the amount of material that has been written and the different approaches to interpreting the Song of Solomon, I would say could be compared only to Revelation. I had no idea. Even early church fathers, early religious writers going centuries back have struggled with what exactly the Song of Solomon is about. I was talking with Sean and Billy before we started the class. There are many authors who take what they call an allegorical approach to it, where they see this as a relationship between Christ and the church. I would be very careful with that. You know, commentaries can say a lot of things about what a passage means. In my opinion, the best commentary on the Old Testament is the New Testament. And I don't see a New Testament reference that aligns with this idea. I think there are some things that you could make application that would be true, but that may not be what this passage is talking about. So we're not starting a study of the Song of Solomon this morning, okay? So please understand that. But we are going to talk about what is unique about the Song of Solomon. Is I don't believe in any other books in the Bible to such an extensive nature do you see the written word espousing this type of affectionate love. I mean, we have books of poetry, but this book of poetry is specifically about affectionate and to some extent erotic love. And we don't see that in other books of the Bible. So we're going to focus on what we do know, and we're going to stay away from what we don't. Fair enough? Okay. If you look in the Song of Solomon, yes, I know where it is. I'm getting there. If you look in verse 2, let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, chapter 1, for your love is better than wine. Drop down to verse 7. Tell me, O you whom I love, where you feed your flock, where you make it rest at noon. For why should I be as one who veils herself by the flocks of your companions? Look in chapter 2 and in verse 4. He brought me to the banqueting house, and his banner over me was love. Sustain me with cakes of raisins, refresh me with apples, for I am lovesick. Again in chapter 3 and in verse 1, by night on my bed I sought the one I love. I sought him, but I did not find him. Verse 4, scarcely had I passed by them when I found the one I love. I held him and would not let him go until I had brought him to the house of my mother and into the chamber of her who conceived me. Look in chapter 4, starting in verse 1. Behold, you are fair, my love. Behold, you are fair. You have dove's eyes behind your veil. Your hair is like a flock of goats going down from Mount Gilead. Your teeth are like a flock of shorn sheep, which have come up from the washing, every one of which bears twins, and none is barren among them. Your lips are like a strand of scarlet, and your mouth is lovely. Your temples behind your veil are like a piece of pomegranate. Your neck is like the Tower of David, built for an armory, on which hang 1,000 bucklers, all shields of mighty men. Your two breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle, which feed among the lilies. Until the day breaks and the shadows flee away, I will go my way to the mountain of myrrh and to the hill of frankincense. You are all fair, my love, and there is no spot in you. Come with me from Lebanon, my spouse, with me from Lebanon. Look from the top of Amana, from the top of Senir and Hermon, from the lion's dens, from the mountains of the leopards. You have ravished my heart, my sister, my spouse. You have ravished my heart. With one look of your eyes, with one link of your necklace, how fair is your love, my sister, my spouse. How much better than wine is your love and the scent of your perfumes than all spices. Your lips, O my spouse, drip as the honeycomb. Honey and milk are under your tongue, and the fragrance of your garments is like the fragrance of Lebanon. A garden enclosed is my sister, my spouse, a spring shut up, a fountain sealed. Your plants are an orchard of pomegranates with pleasant fruits, fragrant henna with spikenard and saffron, calamus and cinnamon, with all trees of frankincense, myrrh and aloes, with all the chief spices, a fountain of gardens, a well of living waters, and streams from Lebanon. Now, I read all of that just because I want you to get the idea. This is not a one-off where he compliments her. I have not talked to Jennifer like this. I'm not. That's right. Hello. I haven't told her hair is like that of goats. Little cultural differences there. But this book does present a wholesome image of the good and the power of affectionate love. And so you can, as we talked about it last week, you can walk away and say, well, that's just shallow. It's just shallow for Christians to be worried about affection and how they look, and that's just all fluffy stuff. No, it's not. I hate to tell you, it's not. It is important. God intended, what is the reason God made woman? He was lonely. He needed a companion. And God created something besides just a friend. Your spouse is not just your friend. Should be your best friend. Don't mistake that. But should be more than just your best friend. But again, that relationship takes investment. You have to work at it. You have to pay attention to it. You have to cultivate it. Or just like a plant, it'll die if you don't tend to it. Now, if you look throughout this book, and we're not going to go into all the verses, there are things that, whether it be the shepherd or whether it be Solomon speaking to the maiden, you see all the physical things that he points out, but there are other things that he points out that enhances her attractiveness or his delight in her outside of just physical beauty. If you look in verses, you know, in chapter 4, he talks about her morality. And how this is something that is makes him attracted to her. And we talked about, I've had several conversations. So if I start repeating things that I said last week, it's because I've talked to several different people and I don't remember exactly. The personality and the virtues and the character of a person can enhance or take away from your perceived physical beauty. I hope that makes sense. Who someone is can make someone more or less attractive. And maybe I shared this last week. I remember in high school, there was a girl, beautiful girl, physically to look at. The more I got to know her, the less so. There was another girl who was a friend of mine, not as physically attractive. The longer I knew her, the more I got to see what type of person she was, I felt a more of an attraction. And I think that we can probably say that on both men and women can say that they've had some experience like that. Now, we all know the phrase, she has a great personality. Or he has a great personality. There still has to be some physical attraction. I think if we try to encourage, and some of you have shared a situation like this, but if we try to encourage our children to marry a Christian for the sake of he's a Christian, and there's none of this, there's no spark, there's no affection, there's no delight, it's more of he's a Christian, you're a Christian, you guys should move forward. No, I think we're setting them up for failure. So let's not swing the pendulum too far. We definitely want our kids to be looking for people that have the right heart and a love for Jesus Christ. But there still has to be this. So as we've read multiple times in the book of Titus, we know that women are encouraged to be devoted to motherhood, to chastity, to sensibleness, to gentleness, godliness, responsibility, all of those things. Men, as husbands, do we appreciate that? When we see our wives doing the things that God wants, does that increase your delight in them? It should. And conversely, husbands, when you're fulfilling the role of a godly man, husband, and father, does your spouse see that, and does that cause her to grow delight in her heart? I would hope so. Yeah.
Notice you stopped short of reading chapter 5. You read about the man and his view about the woman's.
No, please do. I had it in my notes, but No. I passed over it because I got busy talking. Yeah.
Chapter 5, 10 to 15.
Yes. Right. So we did make the point last week that oftentimes it's assumed that men are more visual and that women are more character driven, and some of that may be true. I can tell you that's been presented in other classes, and Jennifer has been like, hey, wait a minute. Girls like to look too. Okay? We have the same sense. And so look at how the maiden describes her beloved in chapter 5 and verse 10. My beloved is white and ruddy, chief among 10,000. His head is like the finest gold. His locks are wavy and black as a raven. His eyes are like doves by the rivers of waters, washed with milk and fitly set. His cheeks are like a bed of spices, banks of scented herbs. His lips are lilies, dripping liquid myrrh. His hands are rods of gold set with beryl. His body is carved ivory, inlaid with sapphires. His legs are pillars of marble set on bases of fine gold. His countenance is like Lebanon, excellent as the cedars. His mouth is most sweet. Yes, he is altogether lovely. This is my beloved, and this is my friend, O daughters of Jerusalem. Now listen, we don't have a bunch of supermodels walking around in America, do we? You walk down the street and you just think everybody's beautiful? Man, how beautiful everybody is. I would argue differently. But sometimes you see a couple together, you know, maybe she's got big mole on the side of her head, and she's not the best looking thing. You look at him, and he's fat and bald, and you're like, and they're just in love. They just think the other is the greatest thing ever. I mean, Jennifer acts like I'm the greatest thing ever, and I'm like, why are you laughing? Oh, anyway. But that's what this love does. It covers all of that. You know, you can see two people interacting in a restaurant or in public or whatever it may be, and you can tell they are just so into one another. They don't look like this maiden's description of her beloved. But you don't have to. This affectionate love, this delight, love is blind. Sometimes that's a good thing. That's a good thing. So thank you for bringing that up, Rod. Okay, we're going to wrap this up in 8 minutes. So, as I stated before, sometimes men, husbands, can tend to think that affection is that's when for bedtime romance, that's for what's going to lead to sex. But that's not the way a wife views affection. And maybe you don't either. I'm speaking kind of in general terms. So please don't take offense if you're like, that's not how I think. A wife needs affection before sex is going to mean anything to her. She needs to feel that affection before erotic love is going to mean something to her. She has to feel that connection. So you have to touch your wife's heart before you touch her body. She has to feel that affection. If you are only giving compliments, if you are only coming around your wife when you want something, women know that. And it's actually insulting in a way, because you're simply doing something to get what you want. And so it seems counterfeit, not sincere. When you show your wife affection, you're actually showing her honor. I'm looking at some notes that were written by someone else, but I agree with them. Deserving the affection is not the issue. Your wife needs it. Affection from you tells her, I will take care of you. You are protected. You are important to me. I am concerned about you. I think about you. You do a good job. I'm glad to have you in my life. Affection gives your wife security, comfort, approval, and tells her she is being pursued and set apart by her man. That seems awfully strong by bringing your wife flowers. But I think if you reflect on it, I think that is what, when you are providing positive reinforcement when you show that affection. And I think the same is from the wife to the husband. But I tend to believe, again, speaking in general terms, I tend to believe this is more of a struggle for men than women. And maybe I'm just basing it on things I've read in my own relationship as far as expressing this type of verbal or these types of actions. We're going to talk just a minute here at the end of the class about the love languages. So there was a book, and I forget the guy's name that wrote it. We've kind of referenced the idea before, but I think that, again, this is not a biblical, we're not saying this is from the Bible, but I think in general it makes sense. This author came up with five different love languages. Number one, words of affirmation. I think this is where women excel. I love you. I need you. You're so handsome. The things that they say to men that reinforce how much they have this delight in their mate. There's quality time. I make time for you. We have date night. I set aside things and make it a priority to spend time with you. We're not always consumed with work and family and kids and sports and whatever it may be going on. I make it a priority to spend time with you. That's the second. Number three is giving gifts. And these gifts can be, you know, like we talked about with flowers or jewelry or whatever it may be. It may be something totally unrelated to the idea of romance. I think I've told you before, I fall into this category. Jennifer mentioned something in passing that she wants. I will go get it. To me, that's showing her affection. Now, does she always perceive it that way? As our relationship has grown, she has. She has grown to see that as I'm showing affection because you want something, you need something, you don't have to say it again. It'll be on the table tomorrow. Not so good with words of affirmation. But anyway, acts of service. Jennifer does the lawn, most of it. Partly because she likes it, which she admitted. But partly so I don't have to do it. When Jennifer's gone for any length of time overnight, I make it my goal, regardless of what condition the house was when she left, which usually is clean, but it's going to be clean when she gets home. I don't want her to come back from a trip and have to worry about doing laundry or doing the dishes or any of that. I want the house to be clean. I think that shows respect for the fact that I took care of it while she was gone. To me, that's showing affection, how strange that may sound. So that's another, acts of service. And then physical touch. And there's a reason hugs are a sign of affection. Even a handshake is a physical touch between two people. Physically touching a human being has very intense repercussions. If you don't touch your spouse for long periods of time, I mean, there's been studies done on the effect of human touch on humans, on the brain. An increased physical touch between two people increases warmth and affection between them. So that's the fifth. So my question is, which one are you? Typically, people have a primary and a secondary. Again, we're speaking in general terms. So just think about these five love languages and think about, who am I? Who am I? And then, who is my spouse? And then maybe start to interpret things that your spouse does. If this is an area of concern in your relationship, well, wait a minute. What is my spouse doing that I'm just interpreting wrong? Well, he did the laundry, but that's because it needed to be done. And you don't perceive that as anything more than just that act. Pam. Gary Chapman.
And then I said, what's going on here? He goes, well, I figured out that you were a quality collector. And sure enough, he was right.
And
he was really good at all other languages.
But not the one you need. And you're right. Some people may read that book or this discussion. It's not biblically based, but I do believe there's a lot to learn. And so as we wrap up, I would hope that you've gotten the key points that we've tried to bring forth in this lesson. You know, this type of love is the love that makes years seem like days, just like with Jacob, right? He worked 7 years and it seemed but a few days. And if you look at the people that you know that have been married for a long, long amount of time, typically this is still there. It's still there. And so I'm going to close with a statement and then a challenge. So my dad had this in his office it may still be there. From the time I was a kid, I can remember it was a little black metal sign and had a picture of a husband and a wife. And here's what the saying said. It said, marriage is an investment that pays dividends if you pay interest. Marriage is an investment that pays dividends if you pay interest. And that's always stuck with me. And so my challenge to you this week is to do or say something romantic to your spouse, whether it's an act, whether it's a statement. And don't just walk out of the building and go, I love you. Okay, I'm done. Try to put some time into it. Think about it. Maybe you already do. But try to do something this week that shows you still feel this way towards your spouse. Thank you for your time.